How was the airplane painted? And what did you all wear? I mean, how identifiable were you as Air Force officers and enlisted?
Well, you can see couple of guys over there wearing black flight suits. Since we flew at night, we wore black flight suits. As far as what we carried with us, we carried a military ID card, and that was it. You left your wallet, your family pictures, and everything back in operations because you didn't want to have any personal stuff on you. Some of us had, you were supposed to only have your name tag, but some of us we had our patches that had the unit patch on there, and then maybe Laotian Highway Patrol, or, you know, there were other unauthorized patches that some of us had on there. And we used to joke about if we ever had to go down over Laos, the one thing you wanted to do was get your knife out and cut those patches off your flight suit so you weren't making the enemy mad if they captured you.
Bruce, as a navigator, describe what it was like flying the missions as a navigator and not being actually flying the airplane.
Well, we flew at night, almost always flew at night. So the biggest challenge was to try to read the chart at night and in the turbulence and in the heavy banking and in the bomb runs. We'd dive down between the karst and the mountaintops into valleys as we'd go after targets. In the dark. And it was challenging to say, okay, what's the elevation and at what point do we have to pull off the targets? So... luckily, it turned out that we made the right decisions and never ran into a mountain.
Man. In 69, were the 123 still flying flare missions for you?
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, you know, they dropped these flare missions from the 123s, and that was a big magnesium-coated log that would light the area in a great amount. And it would come down in a parachute. And we were flying one night, and this thing went by the wing, and we thought maybe that's a helicopter and maybe we could find the helicopter and go get it. So we asked for permission to come around, and we came back around and luckily found this thing again, and it happened to be a dead log. It wasn't lit and in a parachute, and it just went by our wing, went by it twice. Once the first time it caught our attention, the second time when we went back to shoot it. But you know, fate is the hunter. I don't know if any of you have ever read Ernie Gann's Fate is the Hunter. If you haven't, you should do that. And we are here as part of fate and luck and talent. And this is a picture, and that's a picture of talent. The fate is sort of how we meet up with crew members. It's how we are lucky to avoid the tracers when they happen. We've had tracers go by the wingtips. We had one time, tracers came by on the right-hand side. That's my side, the right-hand side. Fairly close to the window, inside the tip tanks. I guess it's fair. They were shooting at us, and we were shooting at them, so that's sort of 50-50, I guess. And I remember saying, holy smokes, that's really close.
Not what you really said.
Well, it's pretty close. Pretty close to what I said. It's what I meant. So I thought, holy moly, if that gunner would move just about a half an inch on the end of his, that'd spray this whole airplane. And well, Tim was in on a dive run trying to hit the gun that was coming up. And so anyway, we came back around. We missed the gun for some reason. And he said, well, we're going to do this again. And I thought, oh, no. And so we came back around, and the same thing. It came over the wing, and I thought, oh, no. So still, and a second gun came up. And he says, well, we'll get that. Same thing came up on the side, and I thought, how lucky can we be? This can't happen. So we did another pass to hit the gun, and these tracers came up by his window. And he says, what are we doing here? Let's get out of here.
We realized at about that time, we realized as we got back up on the perch that there were stories at the bar that guys would tell from their missions and so forth. And one of the old heads' missions was, stories, you do not attack a gun with a gun in the daytime because they can see you. You can't see them because they're in the jungle. And that had just started to get light when we were out there on that mission. And we looked at each other and said, this is one of the stories the old heads told us at the bar, don't do. So we said, okay, we're done.
So how did, yeah, Scott.
So one of the things that we never understood was exactly what your mission profile looked like when you took the ordnance we put on the airplanes and dropped. Can you give us a run through on a typical mission, altitudes you were flying, when you dropped, what kind of ordnance at altitude, what altitude when you did a strafing run?
We missions normally consisted, like I said, of a two-ship formation. We'd go out on the way to the target. You'd be in a loose formation. The lead airplane would have his top rotating beacon on. The number two airplane would be completely blacked out. When you got to the target area, you would be talking to a forward air controller who would be in the target area. And we used what we call a base altitude every night in our frag that came out for the mission. And they would list a certain altitude because you didn't want to say your altitude over the radio in case the bad guys were listening. So they would say tonight, base altitude, let's say, is 5,000 feet. So everybody that was flying that night knew that base was 5,000 feet. So when you get in the target area, the lead would talk to the forward air controller, and he would say, I'm at base altitude plus one. And then the lead would say, okay, we'll be at base plus two and base plus three. So that would put us all 1,000 feet apart. So lead would turn his rotating beacon out so that now we're all blacked out in target area. So we would set up an orbit over where the forward air controller was. He would have some marks on the ground, or if he was using flares, it would be a little bit different. But normally what we call ground logs that Bruce was talking about, he would put three or four out. And from the air in the jungle like that, you look down in there. Of course, there's not many lights around there. So it would look like street lights if you were from the air at those altitudes. We were flying probably 7,000-8,000 feet over the target. So you look down and he'd say, okay, I've got four marks on the ground and they're oriented north-south. So you'd sit there and go around and you say, okay, I see four lights. They look like they're lined up north-south. So that was our reference point. So the forward air controller would say, okay, your target is off the southernmost mark on a heading of 120 for the distance between the last mark and the next mark. So you're sitting there going around in a circle and you look down, you see the marks, you figure out, okay, 120 is that way, and you want to run in toward the marks with them in front of you so that you have that reference that he gave you for how far to drop. And so lead would go around and he would call in. You'd usually call in from the direction and off the direction so you could keep track where each other was. And so usually we were doing 30-degree dive bomb passes. If we were working with flares and we could get down lower, then we'd be down skip bombing or naping and shooting the guns from a lot lower angle. But normally it was at 30 degrees, so lead would roll in from the south and he'd say, I'm off to the north. So he would drop, usually we drop a nape first to get some more marks on the ground. And as lead would pull off, we would be on the perch and we'd be looking for ground fire. So if ground fire came up on the lead airplane, we wouldn't go on a target. We'd go in for wherever the gun position was and try and suppress that. And then when we're rolling in, lead's back on the perch, and if we get fired at, he rolls in on the guns. So you try to suppress the guns first. So it made it interesting. We dropped one bomb or one napalm at a time. We were on the target usually 45 minutes to an hour or more, just going around, just dropping. A lot of times fast movers would come into the target area and they were always out of gas. And so the
fast mover, what kind of airplanes, what type model?
No offense, but mostly F-4s. But they would come in, talk to the FAC, and the FAC would say, hey, Nimrods, can y'all pull off the target? We got some fast movers that are short on gas, and we'll put them in. So we would move over out of the target area, and these guys would come in, and they would ripple through, go through one, two, three, four, ripple their bombs, and then join up again, head back to the officers club. And so then we would move back in and work the target for another half an hour or so. But that was normally how the mission would go. It's interesting, like the navigators are very, very important. The navigator worked the instrument.
It's the first time you ever said that. I appreciate it.
The navigators would set up your munition stations and tell you, you know, which wing the ordnance was off. like Scott said, sometimes we went out with wall-to-wall nape. Our normal loads were either a 6 napalm and 2 500-pounders, 6 napalm or rocket pods on the side. Or as you can see, this one's configured with CBU. We carried an internal bomb load of 72 fragmentation bombs, and later some of them carried funny bombs into bomb bay.
Right.
And then we had the 850s.
What's
in the
a funny bomb?
It's a bomb that drops and then it opens up and dispenses a lot of bomblets that will go down. They kind of form like a, they're about the size of a football field, right? That they would
if
cover.
They worked.
Yeah.
They weren't very reliable.
So that's why we carried more than one.
True.
So that that was the type of munitions we carried. I don't think we ever came back from a mission with weapons on board. There was no reason to carry it out there and not use it. So, you know, our job was to deliver, so we did.
There were times when we would de-arm when they came back. You'd climb up the top and pop the canopy and ask the nav, "Are you clean?" And they'd say, "Yeah." And I remember this one night we climbed back down. I walked over and there's still bombs in the bomb bay, and they said they dropped everything, which meant there's a malfunction in the rack. And at that point, you never knew if it's going to fall out on you or not. That was probably amongst the hardest parts of being an armament guy.
How would you know on a day-to-day, night-to-night basis how to arm the airplanes?
You'd get armament orders from the armament officer. They'd typically be looking at what recon had told them was up on the trail, and you'd arm accordingly.